From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as the UN prepares for a special session on HIV/AIDS, we talk about the search for an AIDS vaccine with science writer John Cohen. His new book, Shots in the Dark, is about the political, scientific, business, and ethical considerations that have made the development of a vaccine so difficult. Charlene Smith is a South African journalist who has been covering the epidemic in the most hard-hit part of the world, sub-Saharan Africa. We'll talk with her about what she's seen in her travels to cities and villages. She's been writing about AIDS ever since she was raped 2 years ago and feared that she was infected. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. A federal grand jury has handed up indictments in connection with the 1996 bombing of an apartment complex that housed U.S. military personnel in Saudi Arabia. 19 American servicemen died in the attack, which also injured nearly 400 other American and Saudi citizens. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The 46-count indictment by a federal grand jury names 14 suspects. 13 of them are Saudis, the other is Lebanese. They're accused of conspiring to kill U.S. nationals in the bombing of Khobar Towers, an attack which the indictment says was supported, inspired, and supervised by elements of the Iranian government.
I know that all of America joins me in offering again our condolences for the terrible losses endured by the families of those injured in this tragedy.
President Bush applauded the announcement and thanked the Saudi government for its help with the ongoing investigation. The FBI says that some of those named in the indictment remain at large but refuse to give specific numbers. Don Gagne, NPR News, Washington.
One of the sponsors of a patient's Bill of Rights is considering an amendment that could appease senators who are not ready to support the bill. Larry Schuler reports from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Along with Senators John McCain and Ted Kennedy, Democratic Senator John Edwards of North Carolina is co-sponsoring S-1052, one of two proposals for a patient bill of rights. Edwards believes his version differs significantly from the other version. He says his bill offers greater medical coverage, better access to specialists, and a process for an independent appeal of an unfavorable HMO decision. But Edwards says there's at least one point where the two sides agree.
Both of us want employers to be protected from lawsuits, from liability. The last thing we need is for employers to be concerned about this. This is about big HMOs and patients and doctors.
Edwards says he's working on an amendment that would clarify how his bill will protect employers from unfair litigation. For NPR News, I'm Larry Schuler in Winston-Salem. Boom, 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 boom.
John Lee Hooker, a legendary blues guitarist from the Mississippi Delta, died unexpectedly in his sleep today in San Francisco at age 83. Hooker maintained a full performing schedule up to his death, rousing audiences to their feet with songs such as Boom Boom Boom. Hooker recorded approximately 100 albums during a career spanning more than six decades. His foot-stomping style and rough, emotional voice inspired generations of younger musicians. In 1991, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 68 points to close at 10,715 in heavy trading of over 1.4 billion shares. Advancing issues beat losers 9-7. The Nasdaq gained 27. This is NPR News. President Bush has sent his special envoy for Northern Ireland to help resolve a growing crisis there that could threaten the 1998 peace accord between Protestants and Catholics. David Trimble, the Protestant head of a power-sharing government, has threatened to resign if the Irish Republican Army does not start turning in its weapons by July 1st. The outlawed IRA said yesterday it will not meet the deadline. New research shows that humans began developing resistance to malaria several thousand years ago at about the same time the disease began spreading rapidly. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
It's a finding that would make Charles Darwin proud. Darwin said that genes that help an individual organism survive will spread rapidly through a population. Now, University of Maryland researcher Sarah Tishkoff and an international group of scientists have found that two mutations that make people resistant to malaria appeared at about the same time that malaria did several thousand years ago. People with these genes survived and passed the mutations on, even though the mutations make carriers more vulnerable to other, less serious diseases. The way the mutations spread right along with malaria is clear evidence of the never-ending war between human genes and infectious diseases. A report on the work appears in the online version of the journal Science. Joanne Solberner, NPR News, Washington.
Two people were pulled from the waters of Lake Erie today after a mid-air collision between two jets from Canada's military aerobatic team. One of the planes crashed into the lake. The other eight planes in the team landed safely at an airbase nearby. The team was practicing for an event this weekend. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next Monday, the UN will begin a three-day special session on HIV/AIDS. An estimated 16,000 people around the world become infected with HIV each day. There have been some medical breakthroughs, like the new antiretroviral drugs that are helping extend the lives of many people with HIV, but we still don't have an AIDS vaccine. My guest, John Cohen, is a journalist who's been covering the search for an AIDS vaccine since 1989. His new book, Shots in the Dark, describes the mix of scientific, business, political, and ethical forces that have made finding an AIDS vaccine so difficult. Cohen writes about science and medicine for Science magazine. He says the first big breakthrough in the search for an AIDS vaccine came in 1984 when the HIV virus was identified. There have also been breakthroughs in our understanding of the immune system. When most people think of immunity, they think of antibodies, but that's just one small part of the picture.
The most important thing that has reshaped the AIDS vaccine search is the ability to find killer cells. Antibodies very simply stop things from getting inside of cells. What happens once a cell gets infected? There's a whole other arm of the immune system that relies on these green berets, essentially, that can find the enemy and eliminate it. And those are killer cells. Well, 20 years ago, nobody could find killer cells. Now there are very sensitive techniques to finding those in people, and those have made a huge difference in the search for an AIDS vaccine.
There was a study called the Nairobi Prostitute Study that tried to analyze prostitutes who seemed to have an immunity to AIDS, who were exposed to the virus but seemed to have an innate immunity to it. Can you tell us a little about what's been learned in that study?
Yeah, it's still ongoing, and what the researchers have found is that there are women who repeatedly have had unprotected sex who do not become infected over years of being in the business. I met with some of the women in Nairobi. I went to their homes. I went to brothels. And it's clear that they're terrifically poor. They live sometimes in mud huts, and they have sex for about a dollar, five, 10 times a day even. And they receive education from the researchers about condoms and also about female condoms. I went to a brothel where they received a lesson about the female condom. Yet some of these women don't use protection and do not, upon repeated exposure to HIV, become infected. Studies of their blood have shown that they do recognize the virus. In other words, they've seen it and they've mounted an immune response to it. And it ultimately leads back to killer cells. And people are trying to design vaccines that exploit that. That group in Kenya is but one group of what are called exposed uninfected people around the world. And there are several groups of exposed uninfected people who've never been studied. I mean, they're hard to identify. You're kind of looking for something that you can't see.
So is the theory that this has to do with those killer cells, those green berets that attack the virus once it's entered the cell?
Yeah, and the theory is that they, through whatever mechanism, learned how to beat the virus at its own game. And there have been a few sobering things that have happened over the past couple of years. A few of these women who were thought to be protected became infected. So it's not a guarantee. But then think about the vaccines in us. The vaccines we have, they don't guarantee we're not going to get the diseases. What they do is they increase our odds that we're not going to get a disease. That's all vaccines do. Many of them increase our odds tremendously, but that's all they do. these women have much better odds of not becoming infected. And I still think there's a lot of mystery as to why that is. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to find more people like this and tease out more of the mechanisms that lead to their resistance.
And what are some of the other scientific routes being explored in AIDS vaccines?
There are basically two schools of thought. One school of thought says, understand the mechanism to the finest detail and then try and build a vaccine that makes the immune system do what you want. Another school of thought is much more trial and error. It's empirical. It says, let's test vaccines in monkeys, see what works, and then move those forward. So both of those approaches are happening right now. The more mechanistic approach uses lots and lots of fancy tools and techniques to make things happen that may or may not work ultimately, but they're pretty swift looking and they sell pretty well on Wall Street if you have a biotech company. I don't mean to be too cynical, but I think that there's truth in that.
Yeah, I'm surprised that there's still vaccines that are working with monkeys, because I thought that HIV affects monkeys differently than it does human beings.
Yeah, it's a good point. HIV itself does not infect monkeys, but there's a monkey cousin of HIV called SIV, the simian immunodeficiency virus. And when that is put into Asian monkeys, it causes AIDS in the monkeys. And there's another virus that's been made in the laboratory that combines SIV and HIV. It's called SHIV, S-H-I-V. It also causes disease in monkeys. So what researchers do is they make vaccines from SIV or S-H-I-V, and then they give those to monkeys, and then they put the virus into them to see whether the monkeys can either completely defeat that infection or become infected and slow the progression of disease or not become sick. And that's the main way that AIDS vaccines are tested today.
What are some of the scientific reasons why an AIDS vaccine is so much more difficult to find than, say, the polio or the smallpox vaccine was?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I think a lot of people skip right over that central question. With polio, antibodies clearly protect people from poliovirus. With HIV, no one knows what clearly protects people. There are clues. Maybe it's antibodies. Maybe it's killer cells. Maybe it's a combination of antibodies and killer cells. Maybe it's something else entirely different. Another thing that distinguishes the search for an AIDS vaccine from the search for the smallpox vaccine, which is a great example, is I think sometimes scientists can become bamboozled and confused by all that they can know rather than what they need to know. Edward Jenner, who made the smallpox vaccine, noticed that, or knew the folklore that dairy maids who got cowpox didn't get smallpox. He took cowpox from a dairy maid, put it into a little boy, then put smallpox into the little boy. Now, that's completely unethical. You couldn't do that today. But that's how the smallpox vaccine was discovered. Edward Jenner didn't know that viruses existed, let alone an immune system. It was completely trial and error.
Since HIV attacks the immune system, is the typical immune response from a vaccine not something that you can work with for an HIV vaccine?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, HIV, I describe it as the arsonist that attacks the firehouse. Because it has evolved to duck and dodge the immune system, it does make it trickier to make a vaccine. It doesn't mean it can't be done, but it's certainly not as straightforward as a virus that doesn't attack the immune system.
Let's look a little bit at the funding issues. Have the pharmaceutical companies invested as much in experiments to find an AIDS vaccine as they have in experiments to find drugs that fight AIDS?
No, I think that's a central problem to the AIDS vaccine enterprise. If you look at anti-HIV drugs, there are 14 different drugs on the market made by 10 big pharmaceutical companies. There are only 4 big pharmaceutical companies that even make vaccines. And I would argue that only one of them has a serious AIDS vaccine program, and that's a recent development. So Big Pharma has, by and large, shied away from the AIDS vaccine field. There's a pretty simple calculus to figure out why they haven't run into it. Partly it is the science. Certainly it's difficult. But the other part is the entire vaccine marketplace for all vaccines that are now sold in 1999 is estimated to have been $4 billion. A best-selling drug that year could have brought in $5 billion, one drug.
Yeah, so who is funding AIDS vaccine research now?
In the mid-1990s, several institutions and organizations and researchers recognized that there was a market failure. One thing that happened was researchers banded together and formed the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, which is a nonprofit based in New York that merges biotech companies with researchers from both poor and wealthy countries to make vaccines, AIDS vaccines, for poor countries. The National Institutes of Health in the U.S. is the single largest funder of AIDS vaccine research. It spends more than the entire world combined. You can't underestimate what it does. It revamped itself in the mid-1990s to become more like industry in many ways, to move vaccines out of laboratories and into people. European Union has gotten together and formed Eurovac, another consortium of researchers. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has funded the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative to the tune of $126 million. I think that's more than all of Europe has spent to date on AIDS vaccine research. There's a lot of good stuff happening right now. I don't think it's enough, but certainly things are turning around for the better.
My guest is journalist John Cohn. His new book is called Shots in the Dark, The Wayward Search for an AIDS Vaccine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Cohn is my guest. He writes for Science Magazine, and he's the author of the new book, Shots in the Dark, The Wayward Search for an AIDS Vaccine. What are some of the ethical problems that scientists are running into now who are trying to come up with an AIDS vaccine and need to find people to test it on?
Well, the ethical precepts should be the same all around the world. The reality is that there are different standards in different places. I'll give you a strong example. In the United States and Europe right now, when there are HIV vaccine tests, if you get infected during the trial, not from the vaccine, but you get infected, the vaccine didn't work, let's say, or let's say you got the placebo, the dummy shot, you get infected, the odds are that you're going to be able to get drugs to treat your HIV infection. What happens in Africa when you're in an HIV vaccine trial and you become infected? It's not the fault of the vaccine, but you become infected. Well, are you going to be able to get drugs? Probably not. And that fact makes it much simpler to analyze whether a vaccine works or not. In other words, if you're in the United States, Europe, Australia, you're in a vaccine trial, you get infected, you start taking drugs, how can the researchers tell whether the vaccine is keeping you healthy or the drugs are keeping you healthy? It becomes a muddy picture. Well, in Africa, it's pretty clear cut. You got infected, then I can just look at you and I can look at the people who got the dummy shot and decide whether it helped you at all. So that creates a huge ethical problem, and people are really struggling with that right now.
So the question is, should the people who are participating in vaccine trials in developing countries have the right to AIDS drugs if they do contact AIDS?
Right, but then
even though other people around them probably aren't getting those AIDS drugs.
That's right, and that raises another thorny ethical issue, which is, is it undue influence to encourage them to join a trial, to volunteer, if they know that they're going to get drugs, if they become infected? Now think about it. If you live in South Africa where 20% of the adults are infected, well, that's pretty attractive. If I get infected, which I've got a 1 in 5 chance of it happening anyway, I'm going to get drugs if I join this trial. Well, that violates ethical principles.
So what are the countries in which vaccine trials are currently underway?
There have been about 50 HIV vaccine trials that have started around the world, and it's a three-phase process. Only one vaccine has moved all the way to the final stage of testing. That's being tested in the United States, Canada, Europe, and Thailand.
And is this a promising trial?
Most researchers have no hope whatsoever that it will work. There is a small group of researchers who believe in it, but the U.S. National Institutes of Health decided in 1994 that the results were so mediocre from early trials in humans to not even move it forward with U.S. government funding. It also, unlike several other vaccines, it hasn't succeeded in monkey tests. It has succeeded in a few chimpanzees, but nobody even does AIDS vaccine testing in chimps any longer. Chimps and monkeys aren't the same, by the way, just so that you know the distinction.
So what do you think is the best hope for an AIDS vaccine?
Well, what I'd like to see happen, I think the great failure of the enterprise as a whole is that it hasn't fully exploited the monkey model. I'd like to see every good idea tested in a head-to-head comparison in monkeys and then move the ones that work the best forward. It's logical. It's simple. It's been called for by leading scientists for a decade at least. It hasn't happened yet. Right now, you can't even compare monkey data from one laboratory and another. They use different strains of SIV to test the vaccines. They have different protocols. They use different places to put the vaccine in, different places to put the virus in when they challenge the animals. It makes me dizzy when I look at that field. I think that it would behoove the world greatly to organize a master monkey trial and then to pick the ones that look the best, move those forward with little concern for why they worked. We can figure that out after the fact.
How does the future of the epidemic look with an AIDS vaccine and without an AIDS vaccine?
Well, drugs aren't going to stop the epidemic. That's not going to happen. Drugs are kind of a wash. I think we've seen that in the United States. When you look at sheer numbers of people who are infected, drugs are going to keep people alive longer. They're going to remain infectious. And you're not going to slow the transmission with drugs alone. That's not going to happen. Drugs also are never going to get, in my mind, to the poorest parts of the world. We only need to look at other diseases to see the problems there. Malaria and tuberculosis, those diseases are still raging. There are drugs that treat both. In fact, there are drugs that cure tuberculosis that don't get to people who need them. We know that vaccines are the most powerful medical tool. They're the most powerful medical intervention other than cleaning the water that we've ever come up with as humans. We know that the smallpox virus now only lives in laboratory freezers. That's it. We got rid of it with a vaccine. That's what vaccines can do. If we had a powerful AIDS vaccine, it could send the virus into laboratory freezers ultimately. It will take time. It will take decades. But it could happen. That's the promise. And another sobering thought is if you have a mediocre AIDS vaccine today, this is a calculation done by the National Institutes of Health in the United States, that works 60% of the time, 60, it will do more good 10 years down the road than a 90% effective vaccine introduced 5 years later. So that's a lesson from the past that we ignore, too. Polio vaccines, the first Salk vaccine, it only worked in at most 70% of the people. Only 70% of the United States population went to get it. Between 1955 and 1961, polio in this country dropped more than 95%. Mediocre vaccine, mediocre coverage. Vaccines can create great good without having a great vaccine.
There's a UN special session on HIV/AIDS scheduled for June 25th to the 27th. What's that about?
It's largely about, in my mind, the success with drugs has led to this question of why don't we have drugs everywhere? I think that's been a trigger for this. It's thrown into relief the disparity that exists in different parts of the world. And that opens the door to a whole bunch of other issues like treating people fairly who have different sexual preferences, treating women fairly who do not have the power that men have in different cultures. And it goes on and on and on from there with all these non-governmental organizations coming forward with their own agendas. I think it's certainly a good thing to encourage leaders in many countries to take HIV and AIDS more seriously. I think it also is a good thing to create a global fund to purchase drugs for poor people around the world. So I'm not negative or cynical about it in and of itself. I think it can do a lot of good. I'm amused at the way that vaccines take such a back seat in this whole operation and how very few people think critically about that enterprise. And I've been following all the chat rooms that are in anticipation of this event, and there's hardly any mention of vaccines.
Would you think it's because people are giving up on it?
No, I think it's because people don't think much about vaccines. You know, people worry more about what's happening to them than they do about what might happen. I don't think people in the United States would wear seatbelts to a high degree if we didn't have laws that punished people who didn't. I mean, you see that in states that don't have seatbelt laws. People wouldn't vaccinate their children in this country if we didn't have laws that prohibited children from going to school who don't get vaccinated. So I think there's a simple problem with preventive medicine versus helping people who are sick. I think that's at the root of it. And then there's this other thing that's curious to me, and it has to do with vaccines sort of being an invisible medicine. You know, most of us get all of our vaccines by the time we're 5 years old. We've never seen polio, diphtheria, tetanus. We haven't seen these things. We're not afraid of them. And we don't think about the fact that we're protected from them. We just are. So I don't think that they're high in our consciousness. I don't think it's something we think about much.
You know, you mentioned that the Salk vaccine and the Sabin vaccines against polio were funded by the March of Dimes, which was the idea of FDR. Is there anything now that you would compare to the March of Dimes?
I think the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative is built on that model. The Eurovac network in Europe is built on that model. I don't think either organization is anywhere near ambitious enough or tapping into the public in the way that the March of Dimes did. That's another huge aspect to all of this. Most people in wealthy countries really don't know HIV and AIDS. They haven't feared it. The way people feared polio was whipped up by the March of Dimes, but it was real, too. Everyone knew someone who had been paralyzed by polio or who had died from polio. I think a lot of people in wealthy countries really don't know people who have suffered from AIDS, or if they do, it's sort of one or two steps removed. It's not a brother, a sister, a mother, a father. It's not the same. It's behaviorally transmitted. It's not casually transmitted. And that leads a lot of people to feel as though if you get it, you know, it's your fault. And I think that's completely wrong, but I think that's how a lot of people view it. And I think that feeds in, too, to the public's appetite for information about it, is they don't really fear it enough.
Well, John Cohn, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Terry.
John Cohn is the author of the new book, Shots in the Dark, The Wayward Search for an AIDS Vaccine. He writes about science and medicine for Science Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In southern Africa, rape and AIDS are horrifically intertwined, causing the deaths of thousands of young girls. We'll talk with South African journalist Charlene Smith, who was raped 2 years ago and has been writing about the epidemic in southern Africa ever since. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Charlene Smith, lives in the part of the world that has been most hard hit by AIDS, sub-Saharan Africa. Two-thirds of the people infected with HIV live there. Smith is a journalist who has been covering the epidemic in her country, South Africa, as well as other countries in the region. She was afraid she had become infected herself a couple of years ago after she was raped by a man who broke into her home. Since then, she's not only written about AIDS, she's become a consultant to South Africa's Medical Research Council on HIV and the AIDS vaccine. Her new book about sexual violence and HIV will be published in South Africa in August. I asked Charlene Smith to give us an overview of the impact AIDS is having on Southern Africa.
The extent of AIDS in Southern Africa is devastating. We've lost 17 million people over the last decade. In South Africa alone, we lost 250,000 people last year. It's expected that there'll be more than 5 million infections in this area alone this year. In Africa, we've got 6 times more girls infected than boys. The highest rates of infection are in girls aged 13 to 19. And overall in Africa, we're seeing that the people who are most infected are teenagers.
Now, you live in a big city. You live in Johannesburg. And you've also traveled around to villages and to the countryside through Southern Africa. I'd like to ask you to choose one of the villages that you visited and describe a little bit the impact of AIDS that you witnessed.
Okay. Well, for example, in Port St. John's, it used to be a very popular coastal town. There you have a situation where people are so poor that they can't even travel to the clinics that have medicines. The local clinic there, all it has in stock is paracetamol, gentian violet, which they use to treat thrush and which is basically useless for thrush, and crepe bandages. They don't even have anything like Band-Aid. Because poverty is so acute, in the afternoons after the children finish school, you get girls from the age of 12 who sell their bodies to tourists for food or to pay school fees or to pay for medication for their parents if they're able to access medication, or even just to be able to get enough money to get bus fare into the local town to take people to hospitals. Tuberculosis programs in that village have broken down as they have all over the country. The problem being that with TB medication, which is exactly the same as with antiretroviral drugs, if you don't have anything to eat when you take the drug, it makes you profoundly nauseous. So because people are so poor and they don't even have a spoon of porridge or a slice of bread to consume with the medication, they're not taking the medication. The consequences of which are that we have one of the worst rates of tuberculosis in the world. Most of the AIDS-related deaths in South Africa are from tuberculosis. That's what you'll probably see on the death certificate. And because we are getting such high failure rates in people taking the medication, we've got the world's fastest growing strain of multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, which costs something like 10,000 times more to treat than normal TB.
You're talking about tuberculosis. I've read that AIDS is really increasing the problem of tuberculosis because people infected with the TB germ and HIV are 30 times more likely to become sick with tuberculosis than people infected only with tuberculosis, people who don't have HIV. So the spread of AIDS is also increasing the spread of tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm. Two-thirds of the population of South Africa already carry the TB bacteria. However, TB doesn't become full-blown or doesn't manifest until your immune system is depressed. And obviously HIV sees that happen. And it accelerates the virus in people, so they're more likely to die quickly. And certainly if they can't take the medication, what we're seeing is just tuberculosis has become absolutely rampant. And within 4 years' time, according to the World Health Organization, we're going to have more multi-drug-resistant TB than any other form of TB. And also that carries an acute warning for us because we are looking at antiretrovirals. I personally am in favor of antiretroviral medication being given to the population, but we cannot give antiretroviral medication to our population or any other population in Africa unless it is accompanied by food relief. You cannot do it unless you're giving people food.
You mentioned that the population that's most hard hit right now by AIDS in Southern Africa is girls of the age of 13 to 19. Why does that group have the highest rate of infection?
I think there's a whole variety of factors. Sexual initiation in Africa, anyhow, is at a very young age. Children in South Africa tend to become sexually active by the age of 12. But you have a very serious situation with regard to rape, very high incidence of rape, and we have an unimaginable problem with virgin rape. But basically, girl children don't have much of a right to say no. And even adult women children don't have the right to negotiate sexual relations. There's a very high tendency among men and boys in not only South Africa, but in Southern Africa and Africa, to take what they want when it comes to sex. A woman who says no risks a beating, and this has been documented all across the continent. But you also have many, because of poverty, as I was mentioning earlier, girls will sell their bodies or they will trade sex for someone who'll pay for school fees or pay for food. Or you even get some girls who are wanting maybe a nice dress or something like that, so they'll trade sex for that.
Now, you mentioned virgin rape is a particular problem.
Mm. It's an absolutely huge problem, and it's completely, completely out of control. Because we're failing to give treatment, and this is where it's really important, you cannot have prevention without treatment programs. Otherwise, the one will sabotage the other. Because we have no treatment or very, very little treatment for people who are infected, a myth has developed that if you rape a virgin, you will cleanse yourself of HIV. And so across Southern Africa, we're seeing an unbelievable incidence in the rape of virgins. In Zimbabwe, as an example, the highest incidence of rape is in girl children under the age of 4. In Botswana, over 1998 and 1999, they reported that the rape of girl children under the age of 12 had risen 65%. In South Africa, child rape, particularly the rape of children under the age of 11, more than doubled last year. And in terms of the myth, there's also belief that if a woman is very old, say from her 70s onwards, she's the equivalent of a virgin because she probably hasn't had sex in a number of years. So very high incidence of the rape of very elderly women as well, very often gang rape. In certain areas of the country, what we are also seeing is a belief that if you sodomize a child, a boy or a girl child, they remain a virgin longer, so you can repeatedly sodomize them to try and cleanse yourself of HIV. And the absolute disgrace about this is that every government in this region knows that it's happening and is not doing anything to either advertise it, say that you can't, that this isn't true, that you can't cleanse yourself of HIV by raping a virgin. And neither are any of the international agencies doing anything about this. UNICEF knows that it's happening. UNAIDS knows that it's happening. The World Health Organization knows that it's happening. And we have this dreadful, dreadful silence and unimaginable numbers of girl children in particular being infected.
Are you saying there's no attempt to educate people at all about these myths?
Nothing.
How did you first learn about these myths?
We started picking it up in rape clinics and then increasingly started hearing from people in the townships and in the rural areas, young people in particular, saying that there was this belief that you could rape, if you raped a virgin, you'd cleanse yourself of HIV. And then I and others began talking to traditional healers or sangomas and asking them about that. Women traditional healers and sangomas are particularly angry about it and have been saying that it's absolutely not true, that you cannot. But they admit that in very many quarters that there's this belief. And it comes out of traditional African cleansing beliefs that if you have a problem that you can cleanse it by having sex with a very young girl. It's believed in many quarters if you have sex with a young girl, it can bring you luck. So it comes out of many of those beliefs, the cleansing beliefs, where you can use sex as a way of cleansing yourself.
My guest is South African journalist Charlene Smith. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charlene Smith. She's a South African journalist who has written extensively about AIDS. In fact, she has a book about to be published in South Africa about AIDS and sexual abuse. She's also a consultant to South Africa's Medical Research Council on HIV and their AIDS vaccine. We were talking about how hard hit girl children are by the AIDS epidemic. There's also a lot of children who have been orphaned by AIDS. What are some of the problems in South Africa as a result of that?
Well, what we're seeing on the streets is increasing numbers of street children, as an example. But the problem with regard to orphans isn't manifesting visibly in the cities yet. We have, according to UNAIDS statistics, we have at least 250,000 AIDS orphans here. And with it, this region, within the next 10 years, we'll have 40 million AIDS orphans. Not a single country in the region has a policy for AIDS orphans. The United Nations Security Council, when they met in February last year, warned that AIDS posed a global security threat to the world. And quite frankly, it's going to come from AIDS orphans, where we have all of these children who see their parents die, first the one parent, then the second parent, then other family members. They're isolated by communities. We'd hoped and we'd believed initially that the extended family would take these orphans in. It's simply not happening. It's not happening for two reasons. One is the amount of stigma and discrimination around HIV/AIDS, but probably more powerfully is the tremendous poverty of most of our people, where they simply cannot afford another mouth to feed. I know a young man who lives just outside of Johannesburg in a township. He's 26 years old. He is the sole breadwinner for 18 people. On the south coast of South Africa, when I was traveling around, as an example, there was an instance where a mother had died, leaving four children. It took 6 weeks to bury her because no one could raise enough money to bury her. The eldest child is 8 years old. He has been left to care for a five-year-old child who has tuberculosis and is probably HIV positive, and two one-year-old twins that are HIV positive. What's happening in the community that he lives in is that some of the villagers will occasionally leave a little bag of food at night for him and the children, but they don't give it to him or them directly because they don't want to be seen to have anything to do with children who come from a household where the mother died of AIDS, and the villagers know it's probably likely that the children are infected as well. And this 8-year-old isn't infected, and one can only imagine the profound psychological damage to this little boy watching all these people die around him and being absolutely powerless. But there is nothing, there are no support groups or programs to help these children.
Let's talk a little bit about drug availability in Southern Africa. I think some of the pharmaceutical companies have recently agreed to provide discounted AIDS drugs to the area.
Yes, they have. It's a process that's actually been going on for some time. Initially, Glaxo Welcome, as they were called at the time, 2 years ago, offered us AZT at 70% below the world price. Government refused to accept that. Last year at the World AIDS Conference, nevirapine was offered to us free to stop mother-to-child transmission. And not only free, but they said that they would deliver it to all of our clinics, which would mean that we would have better access to nevirapine than any other drug in this country. And government refused that again.
Why did the government refuse the drug?
We don't know. Initially, they said that the antiretrovirals were toxic. Then when evidence was produced that they weren't toxic, They then said that they couldn't afford them. Then when the drugs were offered to them for nothing, they said, well, they wouldn't want to start testing every single mother because that might be seen as discriminatory. So at the AIDS conference itself, the scientists of the world said, well, then give it to every single baby born in South Africa, regardless of whether you test the mother or not. It's just a single dose to baby and a single dose to mother. There's no side effects with such a small dose. It won't harm any of the babies, and government again refused that. They then conducted their own trials into nevirapine. It was found to be successful, and they have now started the slow rollout to 5% of our mothers and babies. But the government has made it quite clear that we will not get antiretrovirals for all of our people. And I think that's why some businesses have come in and are starting, but it's a very, very small percentage of businesses that are doing this, are giving it to some of their workers because they realize that the losses of the number of their workers, they will never, ever be able to replace all the people that are dying in their workforces and already starting to die.
President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa has said that he doesn't believe that HIV causes AIDS. Where does he stand on that now? Has he revised that?
He's now saying that he never said that HIV doesn't cause AIDS. However, he also will not say that HIV causes AIDS. And I think the fact that we are seeing so little in the way of treatment extended to our people when we have such unbelievable mortality figures, the incredible denial that we have in our society shows that we are still in denial about HIV. We had a woman parliamentarian approximately 2 weeks ago talk in Parliament about the fact that her daughter was HIV positive. She belongs to Mr. Mbeki's political party, and she said to me afterwards, she said, Charlene, you cannot imagine the number of parliamentarians who came to me and disclosed privately to me that they are also HIV positive. So we have a tragic situation. We watch people get thinner and thinner and thinner in government and in parliament, entertainers, sports people, and then they die. And it's often listed as a dying of a mysterious illness. And we all know what they're dying of. And I think this failure to talk out about HIV also promotes stigma because there's such fear about talking about the fact that you're HIV positive. Instead of saying HIV is a terminal illness, it's a terminal illness like diabetes or like heart problems, you can manage it, you can have a good life, you don't need to go onto the drugs immediately. If you eat carefully, if you watch your lifestyle, you can be saved. But instead, we're not speaking about it, and it's criminal. I think it's genocidal.
You've painted a pretty despairing picture of AIDS in Southern Africa now. I'm sure on your travels through Southern Africa, you've met a lot of people who you consider to be heroes in the fight against HIV. Tell us about one of those people.
Gosh, there's so many. I think for me, the people who I call the angels of Southern Africa are the volunteers, who are usually people who are unemployed themselves. They volunteer to go to the homes of people who are HIV infected. They sit, they speak with them, they'll clean their huts. They're just remarkable. If I think of, and you asked for a specific example, one that comes to mind is a woman called Bernadette Chimasuro, who is with an organization called the Family AIDS Care Trust in Mashvingo in Zimbabwe, in southern Zimbabwe. She lost her sister to HIV in 1989 and pledged to her that she would continue working in that area. She's a woman of 33. She isn't married herself. She's adopted 14 AIDS orphans, 8 of whom are infected. She pays for their own schooling herself. She runs projects, sewing projects for women, gardening projects. One of the problems with regard to women in Africa is their difficulty to negotiate sex. So many programs try and find ways to help women to earn some money. So if they become the breadwinner in the family, they are more likely to be able to negotiate sexual relations. And Bernadette does this unbelievable work. She has only in the last 2 years started receiving a small stipend from an Irish organization. She lives in a tiny little three-roomed house with 14 children. And I just think she is one of these heroines. And we see the Nobel Peace Prize every single year going to all these wealthy organizations and presidents who are doing what they should be doing anyhow. But these are the real heroes of the world and of Southern Africa.
My guest is South African journalist Charlene Smith. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is South African journalist Charlene Smith. She's been covering the AIDS epidemic in Southern Africa. One of the things you're doing is that you're a consultant to South Africa's Medical Research Council on HIV and the AIDS vaccine. What is the state of research now on the AIDS vaccine in South Africa, and what kind of testing is being done?
Testing hasn't started. They want to start phase one trials next year, early next year. They are extremely important trades. We have got clade C or subtype C in Southern Africa, which is the subtype of the virus that has killed more people than any other subtype. In the States and Europe, you've mostly got subtype B, and that's where most of the AIDS vaccine research has been into that. This will be the world's first vaccine research into subtype C. So it's absolutely critically important. One of the issues that we are deciding on at the moment, or that the Medical Research Council is deciding on at the moment, is who will take part in the initial trials. There's such fear around AIDS that many people are anxious about the trials. There needs to be a vaccine education program, which we hope will start in the second half of the year, so that people are more aware about a vaccine, and also so that they realize that if we find a vaccine isn't the cure. It'll still be approximately 7 to 10 years before we find a vaccine, if ever. And as has been found in the United States, even if we find an effective vaccine, a vaccine that's effective in trials, if people don't change behavior patterns, a vaccine that's effective in trials will be rendered almost useless in actual fact.
Why would the effectiveness of a vaccine be so dramatically decreased if people don't change their behavior? Wouldn't they still be immunized?
No, because that's the interesting thing about the HIV virus is that it continually mutates. And if say, for example, I received a vaccine, no one knows if it's possible to get a vaccine that will go across. There's 11 main subtypes. No one knows if it's possible to get a vaccine that will go across all of those subtypes. So if we find a vaccine for clade C in South Africa and it's effective in trials, if we don't stop promiscuous behavior, that causes a problem. For example, I might then have sex, unprotected sex, with a person who has subtype B or subtype D. I then get infected with that subtype of the virus. So I'm not protected against sex with that person. And the danger is that people, once vaccinated, if there's an effective vaccine, will think that this means that they can then start having unsafe sex, which actually, because of the nature of HIV, we're probably going to have to practice safe sex for a long time still, even when we have a vaccine.
You were raped a couple of years ago and were afraid that you might have caught HIV from the man who raped you. And so you took anti-HIV drugs for a while, just in case your rapist was HIV positive or you know, did have AIDS. And it turned out that he didn't and that you were safe. But you didn't know that for a while.
Well, we still don't know whether or not he had HIV. He's never been tested.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. He's never been tested, so we don't know whether or not he had HIV at all, but at least I was fortunate. And one of the, I suppose, advantages about that is the resulting uproar that happened has seen dramatic changes in the treatment of people who raped, but still not good enough. Certainly many of our private hospitals now give free rape care and free antiretrovirals to very poor people who cannot afford treatment. They give free testing and free counselling. We are seeing changes in laws. There is a new law that's coming out that will now allow a rape survivor to request that the person who rapes her gets tested and that she be informed of his status.
When you were raped and were afraid that you had HIV, did mm-hmm. you like make a pact with yourself that if you survived this, you would dedicate your life to reporting on AIDS? Because you seem to have just gotten so deep into the subject, to throwing yes. yourself so totally into it.
Yes, I have. I think that I was lucky to live. The whole time during the rape, I believed that I was going to be murdered. I kept thinking to myself, is this what it's like just before you killed? I kept waiting for him to stab me. And actually, when he did stab me, I can't remember him stabbing me because I think my mind registered that it was non-lethal. But afterwards, yes, I very strongly felt that I had to give something back. And particularly when I saw what was happening to so many women and children, that I thought this is unforgivable. We have to stop it. And if I was lucky enough to be given the chance to live, then I've got to do something to help people who are either experiencing sexual violence or who are at risk from HIV or who have HIV.
Charlene Smith, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Charlene Smith is a South African journalist. Her new book, Proud of Me, Speaking Out Against Sexual Violence and HIV, will be published in South Africa in August. A UN special session on HIV/AIDS begins Monday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shirok. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Brave Journeys, Profiles in Gay and Lesbian Courage by David Mixner and Dennis Bailey, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen King discusses the car accident that nearly killed him. His book about writing has just been published in paperback. Also, we hear from Billy Collins, who was just named the next poet laureate. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.